Get ready. It's time to tee it up with Keith Jones.
Coming up on today's show, we introduce you to Travis Murphy, founder and CEO of Jetter Global, and catch up with John Berquist of Flux Golf. So stay tuned and get ready as you tee it up with Keith Jones. Welcome to the show. So glad you'd be along. This hour, a couple of great guests. We start out with an introduction. Later on, John Berquist is going to come back on the show. But right now, we want to tell you the backstory of how we got this guest. By chance, we were covering an international soccer event in Washington, D.C. It was D.C. United hosting a team from Ghana. And it was a great event. It was Ghana Week, and it's great to be invited and such. And along the way of interviewing different people, I ran into Travis Murphy, Travis J. Murphy. I don't know. It's like Mark J. Murphy. All these Murphys have this J for middle name. We don't know what the J stands for, except there's a period behind it. But Travis is there, and he is the founder and CEO of a company called Jetter Global. That's J-E-T-R. We'll ask him how he came up with that. But what it is this guy works on paperwork to get international players, athletes and such into clear to come into the United States or go around the world. And he, along the way, it's not just soccer. He also delves in golf. So when you think about all these international players that are on the PGA Tour and such, Travis potentially could have had something to do with getting him onto that tour. But let's welcome Travis Murphy to Tee It Up with Keith Jones. Travis, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Keith, thanks for having me. I appreciate that introduction.
Well,
and happy to discuss what the J stands for.
What the J stands for? Okay.
It's James. It's not that. it's nothing fancy.
Oh, it's not. James is English. James is not Irish. What is going on with the Murphy family?
It's Northern Europe. Right, 23andMe indicates it's kind of a blanket Northern Europe.
I am not surprised that you have done some genealogy. I give you a lot of kudos because you seem to be that kind of guy. And so how do you go from growing up and then saying at some point, hey, I'm going to work on this project of getting visas and paperwork done for people, because that's like the back end that people don't think about. The general public doesn't think about, generally speaking. The people that go to events, they're not thinking about that stuff.
No, absolutely. And to be honest, Keith, I'm as surprised as anyone that I find myself in this place. I actually started my career in radio, so a kindred spirit here. I was a station manager for my college radio station and became a news director for a station that had just been purchased by a group of investors that could only afford a 22-year-old news director. And so that was the start of my career, was actually in radio. But it was through that I got to know my home state congressman. This was in Kansas, where I grew up. And he brought me out to Washington, D.C. to be his press secretary. And from there, it kicked off a career that spanned throughout various roles and positions in the U.S. government, and then over to the NBA before starting my own company.
So with the NBA move, were you doing this kind of similar work, or what were you doing in the league?
Yeah, so I served overseas as a diplomat for a number of years, primarily in South America and West Africa. And then my last tour was in an office in the Department of State that does sports diplomacy. Now, that's a term most people are like, how do those two words go together? But the basic principle of this idea of sports diplomacy is just using sports as a tool to build bridges and bring people together through sports. That's something that most countries around the world, frankly, do pretty well because they have a ministry of sports at a federal level that facilitates and oversees sports at a federal government level. We don't have that in our country. We have independent leagues like the NBA, MLB, PGA Tour, and So, you know, we have independent sports entities that really govern their sport and are working to export that to the world, but we don't have anyone at the federal level. And so after my time at the Department of State, I came on board with the NBA at a time that they were really ascending internationally and wanted somebody for State Department that had the State Department experience. So I was kind of right place, right time. I raised my hand and had the opportunity to go over to the NBA at a time where they were really ascending from an international standpoint, both in terms of games overseas, but also in top tier players coming into the NBA. And so I was behind the scenes just making sure that the Giannis Antetokounmpos and the Luka Doncic's and all of those guys, you know, could be where they needed to be. There's paperwork they have to go through and appointments to meet. They have family members, support staff, and, you know, with high level elite athletes, they might have a nutritionist. They might have, you know, their preferred trainer that they work with, or their physiotherapist, things like that. And so it's really navigating that space and helping to convey back to the U.S. government, taking this full circle. We don't have the Ministry of Sports that's kind of explaining this and makes these points clear. So in some ways, it's just being an interpreter and explaining back to the government, like, hey, this is important. It's not just the athlete. It's kind of the whole ecosystem around them to make sure they can perform at the highest level.
Travis, I'm not trying to get you competition or give anybody a nod here, but how many are there other companies that do this? I mean, this is very complex, very legal, and very important.
And very niche. Right? It's pretty specific. Now there's a lot of law firms out there that have sports practices. You know, they do a lot of good people out there file the paperwork on behalf of athletes, and they say, okay, we filed it. Now you do the rest. What we've created with Jeter Global is something that really recognizes, one, that there's this gap that I mentioned in kind of the voice at the federal level around the role of sports in our society. And so we're trying to help fill that space and advocate on behalf of sports and in Washington, D.C., with policymakers that, you know, it's much more than just a nice to have or just a game. There's some real policy implications to what athletes do in you know, exporting U.S. values and ideals around the world. And so we're trying to elevate that, but then we're also really looking at all aspects of travel around an athlete, team, federation coming into the United States. You know, we've got a landscape ahead of us in the United States where we have dozens and dozens of international sporting events, including two of the biggest in the FIFA World Cup in 2026, and less than 24 months later, in 2028, we have the Summer Olympics. We also have the Club World Cup this next summer. We have a variety of, you know, all sports are seeking to come into the United States and really try to capture more of that domestic sports market. So it's a huge opportunity that lies before us as a country. And so part of what we're doing is just trying to make sure that it's prioritized accordingly, sports, and that we're making ourselves a welcoming environment to host these events, no matter the sport.
Well, I feel very honored right now because this guy's super busy. I know he has a number of people working with him and for him, but super important to be timely when you get the paperwork in and such. So I greatly appreciate you joining us for this show, because I do want to move it from the sport of basketball to the sport of football and then ultimately to the sport of golf. And when I mentioned football, because Nigeria is one of those countries in Africa that's a huge breeding ground for professional football players or collegiate football players. And there are other countries in Africa, as you're well aware, that have that kind of a breeding ground, if you will, for the professional entities that are in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the African continent really holds a tremendous amount of potential, I think, that's the likes of which we've never seen in our lifetimes. As you said, Keith, you and I first met in Washington at an event that was celebrating the country of Ghana, which, you know, we have a tendency as Americans to refer to Africa as kind of this singular place. But in fact, Ghana is one of 54 countries on the African continent, and it's very diverse from Tunisia and Algeria and Egypt in the north through the Côte d'Ivoire, the Ivory Coast. That's where I lived for 3 years in my last overseas post as a diplomat. That's in West Africa with Ghana and Nigeria, on down to South Africa and in East Africa. You have Kenya, Ethiopia, that's more known for runners. But, you know, the fascinating thing to me about the continent is the right now estimates indicate that by 2050, so, you know, 35 years from now or 25 years from now, excuse me, more than 2 billion people will reside on the African continent. So basically what that means, about 1 in 4 people on the planet will be African. So fastest growing region in the world. And it's going to be a real demographic shift globally. And sports certainly will be impacted by that, because we're also seeing wealth levels increase on the continent, which is leading to more people having the opportunity to get involved in sports, everything from golf to baseball to football, as you mentioned, basketball. Every sport is seeking to try and figure out how best to position themselves to capitalize on these young people that are hungry, that want opportunities. And so it's going to be fascinating to see how that affects kind of the global flow of athletes and, you know, where we could see ourselves down the line in terms of, you know, whether it's golf, whether it's tennis, no matter the sport, just what that influx of a growing African population would look like.
Obviously, golf does not have much of an African footprint, but golf is very international as a sport. So when you're dealing with players trying to get to the PGA Tour, or players on the PGA Tour that are maybe trying to go over to Europe and play, what's the dynamic of those two?
Yeah, you know, for American citizens and for Europeans, right, some of these sports kind of naturally sort of stratify themselves. There are those sports that tend to be there's a higher barrier to entry to get into the sport. And as such, you know, they tend to reside more in higher income countries. Golf, tennis, those types of sports are like that. That being said, I know the sport of golf and governing bodies around the world, same with tennis, are looking at ways to expand their reach, to increase participation and lower that barrier to enter into the sport. But, you know, that being said, as Americans, Europeans, the world really, it's pretty easy to travel for us. We kind of take for granted as Americans just that little blue passport gets us into most places around the world without too much difficulty. But if you're a Nigerian, even if you're wanting to, you know, even if you have a contract to play professionally in a sport or come to college in the United States, there's absolutely no guarantee that you're going to be able to get in. We work with a number of college student athletes across sports, and at an increasing and frankly concerning number of those are turned away. They go into the U.S. Embassy and say, hey, I've got a scholarship, I'm an athlete in this sport, and I'm going to go over and go to school in the United States. And regardless of having all their paperwork in order, they still get denied. And so that's something that we're seeing. And again, going back to conversations we're having around Washington, you know, there's an issue around wait times and trying to get people in the door and how long that takes at various countries. But just also, what, you know, where do our priorities lie in terms of a country? You know, obviously, immigration is a very hot button issue, a lot of controversy around that. But there's a lot of people who are working to do it the right way and still running into a lot of tripping. Tripwires.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. In our next segment, I want to talk about this deniability, as I'll call it, the reasons that people get turned away. Mm-hmm. With Travis James Murphy. He's the founder and CEO of Jetter Global, J-E-T-R, Jetter Global, and it is a sports diplomacy company specializing in sports relations and sports diplomacy. It's fascinating, and we're pleased to have Travis on, and we'll be back with more Travis Murphy after this break.
All right, this is Trey Cool from Green Day, and we're teeing it up with Keith Jones like we always do. It's a habit we can't stop.
And we're back with Travis Murphy. He is the founder and CEO of Jetter Global. They are working on sports diplomacy. What a background. I mean, you seem to me like to be a pretty young guy. When we met, I'm like, this is a mover and a shaker. You could see that as I watch you operate the hallways and such. But then to talk to you a little bit and find out all this work that you put in for the team from Ghana to come to the U.S. and play against D.C. United at Audi Field in Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, my hometown. And it was great that way. And not to tell stories on the side, but I know you mentioned that there were a number of players from the Ghana team, Ghanaian team, that you couldn't get into the country. So why do athletes get denied?
Yeah, it's a great question, Keith, because you would think, you know, if a person or an entity has a you know, kind of well-established, well-publicized reason for coming to the United States, they shouldn't have any issue in obtaining a visa. And, you know, it's frankly, it's just not the case. So each individual applicant, if they're a part of a team or an individual or part of a family coming over to go to Disney World, they're all judged individually, and they're really looking for three major things. One, is their story plausible, right? You know, where they're going. So I was a consular officer once upon a time. I'll take a step back and say I stood on the other side of the window and interviewed. Ecuador was my first posting, and I interviewed tens of thousands of Ecuadorians over the course of a couple years, just asking them, what's the reason for your visit to the United States? What type of activities are you going to be engaging in? Do you have family in the United States? Have you visited before? Have you traveled anywhere else? How are you going to pay for your trip? And what you're trying to suss out in a fairly short amount of time is, do they have the resources to pay for the trip? Is their story plausible? Does it make sense? And do you have a relatively strong, high level of confidence that they're going to return to their home country? Because that's the biggest thing with a visa interview is just, are you coming back home, or are you going to use this as a way to migrate into the United States? And so it's horseshoes, man. It's not golf. It's you're trying to get close, but you don't get it right every time, and that goes both ways. Sometimes people get approved that probably shouldn't have been approved, and they do end up overstaying. But you know, there's a lot of people that don't get approved that probably should, and it's a heck of a lot easier to deny someone and say, you know what, I don't get in trouble for saying no. I might get in trouble for saying yes to somebody who shouldn't. And so I think, you know, we've seen this shift where it's a bit more, as immigration has become more of a hot button issue, I think these interviews have gotten more difficult for people. And, you know, that's a story, and we don't have to get into the politics of it, but I do think that's a story that's not well understood, just how many tens of thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people are denied visas every year. But, you know, our athletes, especially those coming for an event like this game that we're talking about, we got to figure out ways to make sure that those people are identified and that they have the opportunity to come to our country and participate in these events. And it's just like we're talking with the World Cup, or, you know, if it's a Corn Ferry event, we want to make sure that everybody can be here that needs to be here to participate, because it brings eyeballs, attention, and adoration to the United States, and that's something we want.
Travis, you mentioned three things. So the first thing was a plausible story, and I'm not sure if you wove the other two in there, but what are the other two? You said three, list of three.
Yeah, and then resources. So do you have the finances to pay for your trip? And then the third one is, are you coming home? What reason do you have to come back to your home country? And, you know, for a 22-year-old soccer player or a young athlete, which, I mean, let's be honest, most athletes in their prime outside of, darts and competitive drinking really are in their 20s. They're young guys, right? They're young men and women. And so they may not have the same level of ties as somebody who is a bit older. And so that's a struggle. And, you know, it's understood that a 22-year-old may not make a great visa applicant because there isn't a good reason. They may not have any resources, but if they're traveling as part of a team or they're a legitimate professional athlete, and certainly in this day and age where everything's Googleable, we should be able to identify that and make sure that they can be a part of their event in the United States.
Wow. I just heard a sport that I might be interested in. Did you say competitive drinking? I don't need a visa for that.
Being a young man, that may be the only threshold where I...
I misspoke. I said I didn't need a visa for that, for competitive drinking. You do definitely need a visa or a MasterCard or something for competitive drinking. Travis, it has been indeed a pleasure to have you on. Great indeed. Travis J. Murphy, President and CEO of Jetter Global. Unbelievable story. We'll be back with John Berquist after this bottom of the hour break.
The Dalai Lama. If I'm on a first tee with him, I give him the driver. He hauls off and whacks one. Big hitter. The Lama. Long. Into a 10,000-foot crevice right at the base of this glacier. You know what the Lama says? Gunga Galunga. Gunga, Gunga Galunga.
Welcome back to start the second half of the show. Spending it now with a guy we've gotten to know pretty quickly over the last number of months since the first time we had him on the show. Actually, his reputation preceded him because our buddy Joe said, hey, you need to have this guy on your show. And now I can't get the guy not to come on my show. I'm talking about our new friend, John Berquist, probably in his factory, in his studio in Seattle, Washington, of all places. I know that's a golf mecca to a lot of people, but that's where he is for some reason. But JB, welcome back to the show.
Steve, thanks a lot. And you must have a camera on me because I haven't left the studio all day.
Well, you know, yeah. you're one of the hardest working men in golf that a lot of people are less aware of. And it's unfortunate because, and this is part of why we've taken a liking to John so quickly, is because this guy's an innovator. He is an inventor. You know how we feel about those kind of people. We love them because they do great things and things that nobody ever thought about. And this Flux Golf that you've got going on. Now, John, it's just come off a lengthy time on the LIV Tour with a lot of success, a lot of players. And when you're out there as a rep on the LIV Tour, it's very, very special to be out there. Unlike the PGA Tour where you got a lot of the big manufacturers and anybody a lot of times can get on out there. It's a little different for LIV. So I know you put quite a few road miles on, air miles as well, and it was a pretty successful season for you. Now, we'll start there because word on the street, and it's a pretty wide street, is that Greg Norman will no longer be leading the charge going forward. So that's made a lot of people happy. I have not talked to anybody or heard from anybody that said that's a bad move for anybody. So it appears to be what's going on.
I think so. I have had, several discussions over the last season and especially over the last three or four events. But, to answer your first question, the special nature of LIV has several layers to it. There's a lot of things that you should believe on the headlines, and there's elements of it that are kept from us. And unfortunately, because of no TV deal, significant one at least, we're not privy to some of the other relatable aspects of these athletes that we used to follow week in, week out. What I can tell you is my ability to have access to the putting green week in, week out is tremendous. And I don't take that for granted. And that's why I'm out there with this opportunity at hand, because I have access to all these different tour players and to their coaches and to the caddies. It's a special environment, and as you stated, not everyone's welcome. The protocol follows as you need to have a working specifically with a professional, and you may have your tour-wide credentials for the year, but they actually are given out per event. So not only do I have to get, the A-OK from the tour-wide credential sort of department and keep that updated, but
a week-to-week basis, they ask who I'm working with, and they'll verify with the coach or the player specifically. And if I don't get that sign-off by the player, I don't have my credentials for the week, and I can't go out there. So working with two or three guys that vouch for me week in, week out was special. And when you look around and you're seeing, well, there's only two other manufacturers out here. If you took it like Chicago, well, there usually is only one. And there was two because it was in Bob Bettinari's backyard. So Bob's close with Liv and with the founders. And so it's fun having those dialogues with other tour reps, and you know, I'm repping my own product. But you're also seeing, you know, half the other guys playing with a product that you designed. And, you know, we're all kind of rooting for each other. I mean, we really are. So that access is something that I cherish. And what I'm trying to do right now is figure out how to make it pencil for next season.
Yeah, pencil, you know, pen it in, you got to figure it out. But, you know, when you have that kind of exclusivity, obviously it speaks volumes to the kind of product that you're making. But it also makes sense in general to do it that way. I'm not a big proponent of doing it that way, but I understand it because they're trying to isolate and layer these players so they can go out and play their golf and collect their enormous check and not be bothered by reps or somebody that wants to put product in their hands. But there are some players on that tour specifically, one Bryson DeChambeau comes right to the top of the list, that experiment all the time and try their own things and are open to innovation.
Bryson's a great example. You know, another one is Phil. These guys know what they're talking about. So I would say they're the of the few when you're out there who understand just some of the basic around physics and, you know, not using these, you know, rhetorical, oh, it feels great, or, you know, that suits my eye. Both those guys, Phil and Bryson, are willing to get into the weeds with you. And if you sit back and listen, you start to learn a few things, too, which are valuable to them. You know, Bryson owns, or is it not, I'm not sure he owns, but he definitely is a shareholder in the products that he has. You know, he has the Sick Putter he has shares in, the LA Golf Shaft, and then Jumbo Max. So for him, he has the three components that make up, you know, the product that I'm designing. He has, you know, some connection to financially. So in a way, he's obligated to nurture those brands and bring them to the forefront. And when you're out there and you're dealing with people who have, you know, some tie, financial tie, or maybe even emotional one to the brands they're using, it's not easy necessarily convincing them to come over. But as soon as they realize that my job is to bring innovation from a certain perspective and allow them to use it, they're much more apt to gravitate towards my side of the putting green, grab a club. And when that happens, I just say, hey, thanks, check it out, let me know, and I'll come back, you know, 5-10 minutes later and see what they think. So it is special, but, you know, there's half the guys who, you know, will play with the Scotty Cameron because it gives them that same visceral feeling that we all have when we play with the Scotty Cameron. You know, it just feels right because of the name. Is it, you know, just oozing with technology? No, but there's some good things that are, you know, make it comfortable, and there's an emotional connection, which I think translates into how we play golf. So it's special, and, you know, I'm still the newbie out there. They know who I am through my ties to, you know, Golf Saudi and my interaction with them over the last 5 years and now through the lab product. But I'm still competing with OEMs that are giving them a bag or giving them some money. So, you know, I can continue to get out there, and I know that organically over time, we're going to see a migration of some of these players that will use my product. And that's what I'm taking advantage of right now, Keith, is this opportunity. And I hate to, you know, not be in an event where at least my network doesn't grow. I may not get playability from these guys, but at least that network and that connection and ability to have access to them it's priceless.
I'm glad you mentioned Bettinardi, because it took Bob quite a number of years, and his son is involved now too. But Bob Bettinardi was on the show quite a while ago, and he makes a good product. And I still occasionally will play my Bettinardi putter, and which Bob gave me personally. So obviously it makes it extra special that way. But you know, the guys that do the putter specifically. And I think back even to Dick De La Cruz, who had his own company before Ely Callaway bought him, and then involved Dick in the design and such. And we talked so many hours about that. You guys have this special mind for that specific technology. And I know Dick, before he died, was working on a shaft and a number of different things, because there are only three components. I mean, you have the head, you have the shaft, and you have the grip. And all three are super important. But when you look at all the time that a guy like Bob Bettinardi put in to develop his name, and Scotty did the same years ago, and you know, it's about relationships, and Scotty got fortunate from the standpoint of he had a good company come in and use his name, and you know, you don't even think about Scotty Cameron as a person anymore. You think about it as a brand and as a putter specifically. If you say Scotty Cameron, people don't say, "Oh, that I met that guy last month." They say, "Oh, yeah, I have one in my bag."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bob has built a tremendous company because I think he's been able to connect with a consumer in a slightly different way than Scotty. Like you said, Scotty's like this entity, God-ish figure, this deity that we all envisioned him in his, you know, studio, you know, using the million machines himself and programming and design. And I'm sure he does do some of that. He doesn't make all of his product, and I guarantee a lot of it's not made in the States. What Bob has done is create a large volume manufacturing combined with beautiful design, and done it, you know, in a homegrown fashion where he is manufacturing his product, you know, just outside of Chicago. So that is another element that I believe has been part of his formula on not just, you know, controlling costs and controlling inventory, but I think the timing, you know, when you have your own machines and you're able to press a button, and most of the OEMs have their own machines and they can turn things for tour players, but you have the ability to control the language and what you want to sell to the public. And these limited offerings that we see are bespoke putter companies. You know, that's what they're doing. They're making a living off of small batch products that are truly handcrafted. And they release them in a limited run, and they're expensive, but they're totally worth it because, you know, this person's heart and soul and time and energy and sacrifice has gone into this creation. And it just so happens that it's in the form of, you know, a putter, which is like this performance art that we all can tap into on an individual level. And I've played much more in the realm of volume. Even though most of now I'm looking at, you know, what are the opportunities that exist in the putter space on a smaller bespoke level. You know, I'm not a machinist. Yes, I do all my CAD and I do my designs and I use other people to manufacture product. But, you know, can someone who, you know, has this dream of becoming a putter maker go out and buy a 3D access Haas machine for $70,000 used and become a machinist and pump out putters? I think they can. I think they need to be realistic though about what they ask for them. I think the more you charge for your time and the effort and the sacrifice, the more successful you're going to try and, you know, you will be. If you try and, you know, tackle a sub $300 or sub $500 putter with, you know, your own machine in your backyard and you're leveraging yourself to do so, you're making a mistake, because there's plenty of people, and we can name, you know, Tyson Lamb. There's, you know, there's four or five of the ones that I can point to who understood, if I'm going to take this type of risk and follow my passion, let's do it in a way where I can provide for my family and, you know, charge fairly for what my value is. And creativity is something that needs to have more value. And, you know, all the people who work for big OEMs and designing product, and, you know, I'm just like those guys. You know, those guys are out there doing the same thing day in and day out, creating incredible product, except they have to then funnel all that through, you know, this template in a funnel that says, can we make it pencil for the masses, and can everyone get the little share? And at the end of the day, technology usually takes the back seat.
Talking to John Berquist, Flux Golf on Tita Keith Jones, innovator and an inventor. And Flux is a brand that's a leader in pushing the boundaries of putter technology through innovative designs and advanced materials. Now, I know your putters are a little up in price, but I've heard numbers that people have spent on Cameron putters, and it it's like, wait, I could have made a car payment.
Or bought two cars. I mean, it's one of the two. I mean, it spans the spectrum.
So the guy I'm going to mention to you is a guy that's been in the industry for a long time, and his name is Sean Toulon. And I'm sure you putter brethren know each other and such. And Sean is kind of doing his own shingle now, I think. But obviously, when you work for a big company before you break out on your own, sometimes it comes with some credibility.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, if I didn't have the success of the lab stuff, even though a lot of the players knew me, I probably wouldn't have been able to get onto the putting green. And it absolutely translates into, you know, potentially going out on your own and, you know, having a following. You know, I mean, it helps tremendously. Now, Scotty's been in that zone where he's been his own entity underneath the umbrella of Titleist. So I think that, you know, Sean was able to do it a little bit underneath Odyssey, but, you know, that is rare. Right now we've seen Austin Rawlinson, who ran Odyssey for years and years and years, now move over to Scotty Cameron. It'd be great if you had, you know, almost a patron that could sponsor you going out on your own and connecting the dots and, you know, really allowing you to be a creative. But most of us on our level are doing everything. You know, we're doing the numbers. We're, you know, we're fortunate enough to have employees running our machines. I mean, it doesn't scale up too much outside of like, well, I'm the master of none and I'm running the company myself and, you know, maybe the help of my spouse. That's where I'm trying to leverage what I'm good at. I'm really good at design. I'm understanding my understanding of materials, material science, and then manufacturing is where I'm going to leverage sort of that next gen Flux product. And I'm turning the corner on a few cool ideas that I believe will help me not only manufacture product faster, but manufacture product with, I'd say, less governance by the constraints of CNC machining. So I'm hinting at 3D printing. So that's the realm that I'm going into, Keith, is I'm really exploring down what can metal 3D printing look like, from cost per unit to how many we can actually print up in X amount of time. Can it scale? And then what's an appropriate price point? So, you know, that's kind of the question you posed. You know, yes, putters can become expensive, but what is the threshold for a volume? I mean, I believe the latest numbers are around $700 to $750 for a pretty basic lab putter.
Well, that's pretty crazy. We're with John Berquist of Flux Golf. When we come back, we'll talk more about that 3D printer stuff and what to look for when you're looking for a putter. We'll be back after this break to wrap up the show with JB. Back for our final segment of the show. It's been a pleasure to spend some time not only with Travis Murphy, but our man JB on the ground in Seattle, the hotbed. I know Jim McClain loves Seattle. He bought a place out there just so he could get away from the Miami heat in the summertime. But, you know, other than Freddie Couples and a couple other people, you don't really think of golf in Seattle in the same sentence. Although I know the golf out there is fantastic. I know John Berquist is going to tell me all that stuff if I let him. So I'm not even going to We're not gonna. Well, maybe the next time he comes on, we'll talk about all that beauty and stuff, and you can stay at John's house, and see his lab, and then go play golf as well. But before we get to that part, I want to explore this 3D putting experience. This 3D printing is something that Bryson DeChambeau has worked with and stuff. And I'm not sure. I know I say this personally. I'm not totally sure exactly what the heck that means, and I think some of the people listening to this show probably are in that same boat.
I'll try and break it down quickly and succinctly. You have a bed of material, powder, metal, right? Then you have a binder, glue. Then you have to have something that binds it, heat. So currently, when you're talking about metal being built on different layers, you're using lasers. And so lasers are actually what's binding the material with the adhesive on a very, very, very thin, just think about it, just a stack of papers. That's in essence what 3D printing is in the specific arena of metals. And so now we have different stainless products, aluminum, titanium, tungsten, coppers, different alloys within those genres of materials that we can print up. Now, here's the fun and exciting part from a design and from a consumer standpoint. Most mallets, because of their size, if they were all stainless steel, they would weigh 800 grams. Most of them right now are made out of aluminum, some plastic. Maybe there's some stainless within that product. But that gets its amount down to more of like, you know, a reasonable level of, let's say, 350, let's say high-end 380 grams. With 3D printing, the inside of the print can be voided, and that's basically structural lattice. So, I mean, when people think of the word lattice, you kind of think of that sort of like shading thing that you do, and it's a cross membrane. Well, you can do that within the shape or of a form, and it lightens the material. So now what 3D printing out of stainless allows me to do is create a shape the size of a standard mallet, and it not being, you know, some sort of like blend of plastics and aluminum, it's now one solid monolithic 3D printed stainless part. So there's a benefit there.
Wow. Okay. We're going to digest that a little bit. All right. So somebody is looking for a new putter. Now, so name aside, what should somebody look for when they're trying to select a putter?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question. You know, fitting is tremendously empowering to really dialing in what's the right equipment for each individual. So for all my fitting studios out there, then my friends that run them, I'm going to suggest people actually go get fit for a putter so you can analyze what your swing path is. And, you know, based on that swing path, that's going to dictate the style. More arcing swing path, you're going to probably have something that's more on the blade side, and different weightings within specific mallets. If you're more of like a true, like straight back, straight forward, you know, you might find some success in like the lab or center shafted or a full mallet. So, you know, that's my suggestion. If you want to actually truly get your putting into a new place and feel confident about it around physics, I would definitely lean towards going to a fitter. You know, another big element, and I did a fitting on Friday for someone, and they were a pretty tall person. They were 6'2", and they were putting with a 35-inch putter, but they were totally on the heel side. And so I said, wait a second, let's see how long your arms are. And so when we fit them, I put him down to something just below a 34-inch. The putter sat flat. We could see his line. So that's the benefit for anyone. If you want to go out and actually truly change your putting and like the performance of it, go get fit. And then if you want to buy one, get fit, then go to my website, fluxgolf.com, or you can send me a direct message, john@fluxgolf.com, and I can see what I can do from there. But honestly, there's so many other components. We're seeing anti-torque in shafts. We're seeing, you know, different polymers and technologies within the face, different grip technologies.
John Berquist, my guest on Chief with Keith Jones. Special thanks to Travis Murphy as well. but we're just out of time. Get out there and practice your game. Hey, work on your putting, too. Practice, practice. Take your game to the next level, and we will talk to you next week. Take care.